The world's steadily growing population, its severe environmental problems and unsettled economic conditions, from the poorest nations to the most wealthy, are not regional issues or even national ones. I'm Susan McInnes for Conversations. My guest today says they need an international commitment for change. We'll talk today with the president of the Population Institute in Washington, D.C., Werner Fornos. Werner, thank you for taking time.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
You and I talked in 1988, and when we did, the population had just about hit 5 billion people. We heard on the news recently it has gone past 5.5 billion people. If we keep moving at this rate, how fast do you think it's going to take to get us to the planet's literal holding capacity?
Well, we are going to see carrying capacities exhausted regionally at first if we continue to grow as we grow now. The interesting part of that is we don't have to keep growing like we are. We have the technology, we have the knowledge, we have the demand for changing our reproductive patterns, but we lack the political will to do so. There are people who say that we have already reached the carrying capacity. Lester Brown of World Watch Institute thinks in many areas we have already exceeded what is a technological carrying capacity. A new book is about to be out by Donella Meadows and her husband and researchers at Dartmouth University. They were authors of the book Limits to Growth in 1972. They've gone back and taken a look at that book and were shocked with what they found. And using the same models and projecting forward this rapid increase that people thought was going to end in the 70s, that we were going to taper off, they now have come out with a new book. And ironically, the title is Beyond Growth. And so they're making the premise that in many areas we have already exceeded what this planet could really tolerate. We're now growing at 100 million every year. And what's instructive about that is 90 million of that 100 million is born into the third world, a world that's already terribly torn by civil strife and social unrest and where people live in brutal poverty.
There's a group of people, children, 3 billion youngsters now entering their reproductive years. Will this further accelerate
the predictions? It's almost unbelievable. 3 billion young people entering their reproductive years, that was the entire population of the world in 1960. So how well they're going to be able to carry out that awesome responsibility about parenting, when to become parents, hopefully when they're fully mature and capable of entering this very, very special time in life, parenting, limiting the number of children that they'll have to the number they can love and take care of and see grow to responsible adulthood, and also making sure that they properly space the pregnancies that they will have so they protect the health of the mother and the infant in the process. If we were able in the world today to be able to come up with pregnancies spaced 2 years apart, we would save close to 500,000 women each year who die from complications of pregnancy. And untold numbers of infants could be spared. We often do things very blindly. But about the 3 billion, if we don't come to grips with the fertility of these 3 billion, and if they all wind up with 3, 4, 5 children, then we're heading for an environmental Armageddon. And we could be very well committing the ultimate global blunder, one from which there's no recovery.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes, and with me is Werner Fornos. Since 1982, he has been the president of the Population Institute, based in Washington, D.C. It's the largest private nonprofit organization working on population issues. It is an outgrowth, founded in the 60s, of the Methodist Church's Board of Social Concerns. Werner Fornos joined the Population Institute in 78. He served as president, as I said, since 82. I'm going to, I think, ask this question later in other forms, but it seems to me in the 1960s, when a great number of new thoughts were under consideration, in some chaotic way, but still under consideration, there was a concern about our burgeoning population worldwide. Why do you think it has slipped away, evaporated? Why in the last 30 years haven't we been able to grapple?
Well, it's not just in population, but in everything we do. Whenever an issue gets onto the plate of public opinion, we have a very, very short attention span. We launched the war on poverty. We launched the hunger campaign. We launched women's rights campaigns. You can almost chronicle a whole series of annual concerns that keep our attention for a very short time, and then we forget about them. None of them have been solved. We've just gone away from them. We've taken up the new latest fad, whether it was disarmament or whether it was, and I don't mean that in a facetious way when I say disarmament, but we had a tremendous struggle over the Vietnam War, and then it just is a succeeding crisis after each other. But when a headline appears, as it did in the 70s, that U.S. achieves zero population growth, we said, well, we did it. We cleaned our hands and we turned away. I'll give you an example. When the Washington Redskins beat Buffalo, even as sophisticated a newspaper as the Washington Post ran a banner headline that said, Washington wins world championship. Never mind, no one else plays the game. You know, so we declare ourselves, whatever it is, it isn't just a United States phenomenon. We make believe that if we do it, the world has solved it. And that's what's happened with population. And since we live in a demographically divided world, we don't see the population problem. I mean, it's very difficult for people in Alaska with 555,000 people, and this enormous land, to think that we have a population problem. But if you happen to live in a country like Bangladesh, Bangladesh in Southeast Asia is the same size as Wisconsin in our lower 48. Wisconsin has 4.5 million people living in it. Bangladesh has 118 million people living in the same space. And that is not an unusual example that I pulled out of my hat. You could do that in country after country, on continent after continent. We in the industrialized world have stabilized our population. Having said that, the United States is still the fastest growing of all of those industrialized nations. Last year, our fertility, number of children born to a woman during her reproductive lifetime, climbed to 2.1 children per family. If it climbs to 2.3, just to give you an example of the explosiveness of this growth, if it climbs to 2.3 in the next couple of years, we will have 50 million more Americans than we anticipated. So we're not out of the woods yet, especially when you take a look at the consumptive lifestyle that we have. You know, a child born today in Fairfax will, before he or she reaches age 75, which is a pretty reasonable guarantee, preventing other disasters. On the natural lifespans now, we've gone up to 80. Child born today, by the time that child reaches 75, he or she will have produced 52 tons of garbage, consumed 10 million gallons of water, and used five times the energy than a child born into the developing world. So we have a special obligation, in my opinion, to really be part of the world solution to this problem.
This problem of population growth is in no way singular, then. It has to do with numbers. It has to do with consumption. It has to do with impact on the economy, on resources, on all the way down the line.
On the environment.
I want you to take a look now at the environment.
Right.
Most people, I think, would not make that correlation between population and environment.
Well, while we're meeting here today, things aren't very reassuring in the world. And if our listeners could just somehow think globally, they would be shocked to realize how seriously our environment and our resource base is being threatened. I said things aren't very reassuring in the world. Our forests are declining. Our topsoil is eroding. Our deserts are expanding. Our planet is heating up. And the ozone layer, the protective layer of skin over the Earth, is thinning. Let's look at those all for just a second. When I say our forests are declining, we are cutting forests during this decade that amount to 370 million acres. That's the entire size of Alaska being decapitated, cut down, many of them non-replaceable forests. The most prohibitive cutting is taking place in the tropical rainforests. Because they have so much mystery in them, so much excitement, we do pay attention to that. But also within those tropical forests resides so much of our biological diversity of both plant and animal life. And we overlook the fact that they're also the lungs of the Earth. So while on the one hand we're dirty in the atmosphere to the point where we're seeing global warming, we're at the same time cutting down the one piece of nature that can help us clean up the atmosphere and restore our oxygen. Besides the tropical rainforest being cut at 100 acres a minute and thereby destroying species, many of them not even cataloged yet or identified or measured for what kind of medicinal help there might be in those plants. One of them may very well contain an antibody for a vaccine on AIDS. So destroying these tropical forests is something that the whole world has to address, but we have to address it in fairness. Here we are, the rich northern part of the world, saying, hey, you can't do this to the resources of this planet. They say, what do you mean? You did it. And now you tell us it's no good for us. You've gotten your riches. You've established your level of living. You've established your economic vitality. And here we are trying to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. And you're telling us, don't destroy our natural resources. So we're going to have to come up with a quid pro quo. What I see most likely happening in the next 10 years is that the industrialized nations are going to forgive debt in return for swapping it for nature preservation, so that the resources of the world that all of us are so dependent upon will be kept for future generations, but we will reimburse the nations who would have otherwise been able to use them for financial gain. The reason they're cutting those rainforests is because they're hard-pressed for foreign currency, which they need in order to pay off the interest rate on their prohibitive debt. They don't even have the money to touch the principal. I mean, and they probably never will. That's why I think it will become a quid pro quo. Knowing on the one hand you're not going to be able to get your money back anyhow, why not get something worthwhile that future generations can count on?
And do you think the industrialized nations of the world, the wealthier, the more powerful, have the consciousness that it will in the long run help us all to forgive this debt, to keep these forests alive?
Well, they may not have the consciousness at this point, but 100 nations economically stagnant
currently, so, right?
Currently, yeah. Will have a significant impact upon the industrialized nations because of the limitation of the markets. Empty pockets can't buy even the best goods from Japan or the U.S. or Germany or all the other industrialized nations. And so I think that economically rather than humanitarianly, they will be motivated to move. But I think also as the environment continues to deteriorate, they're already seeing it. The ozone layer over Europe now has been depleted and measured, coincidentally, by the technology that we have so cherished and relied on, by 20%. The ozone layer over Alaska and the northern tier of states in the United States and southern tier of Canada has been measured just with a new U-2 plane that's been converted from spying to measuring technological breakthroughs. And the status of the atmosphere has measured a 10% depletion over our areas of ozone layers. And the vast damage that we have done to the ozone hasn't even arrived up there yet. It takes one molecule of chlorofluorocarbons, the principal culprit in the depletion of the ozone layer, 15 years to reach the stratosphere some 17 to 25 miles above us. So what we're at the moment getting excited about is what we did 15 years ago. That's what's arrived. And in the intervening years, we've had a tenfold increase in reliance on CFCs, and they haven't even arrived up there yet.
Is the relationship between population and ozone that tenfold increase, or is ozone another problem that will plague us given that there are too many using too much?
The machinery that is using ozones is developed for the use by man. Refrigerators, air conditioners, containers, all kinds of industrial uses and domestic uses and military uses. And every time that we open a refrigerator door or we use Freon, we are contributing to the depletion of the ozone layer. And we have the technology to stop that. We are very afraid that we will get multinationals unhappy with us if we demand consumer protection and that we demand that they accelerate getting rid of these harmful gases. Because you see, ozone depletion, which amounts in a greater penetration of the sun rays of the sun, The rays of the sun coming through the earth affects our immune system. It affects our eyesight. It affects our skin, causing skin cancer, and also affects agricultural products and marine life. So this is one health threat that is very real. And all of us would like to be healthy and be spared any kind of destruction of our lives. I mean, the reason we all love the future is because we hope we have a place in it. And we better start worrying about that future.
I want to return to forests for a
yes.
moment. Go ahead.
I wanted to, too, because I only talked about the rainforest. But let me just say that 70% of those of that massive deforestation or 70% of all third world families are dependent upon wood as their sole source of fuel. And a hungry family is not going to worry about preserving the forest if it needs wood to cut down in order to make a hot meal because they have no other fuel.
There's also the concern as forests disappear that topsoil will also disappear out from under us. How is that so?
Last year, we lost 26 billion tons of topsoil. Measured again by our technological wonderful satellites, and we were able to measure not only water-borne loss of topsoil, but also wind-blown loss of topsoil, which is now one of the principal contributors to expanding deserts in Africa. The 26 billion tons of topsoil that were lost principally due to urbanization, to marginal farming, and to desert expansion. No place is desert expansion more rapid than in the continent of Africa, which is the fastest growing continent in the world now. They have a continent-wide 3% population growth rate, which means they will double their population in 20 years as opposed to the rest of the whole world doubling in 40 years. They're only able to increase their food production by 1%. And so you can see this warning that I made earlier that carrying capacities will be threatened regionally at first. Certainly, deserts are expanding now in Africa annually at a rate of a new 6 mile deep belt all the way from Mauritania across to Djibouti. Poor farming, again, this marginal farming, the deforestation, using very inefficient animals. Nomadic tribes using goats, and goats having the capacity not to just nibble at the vegetation that they want, but they take the vegetation and the roots with it. And then, of course, this burgeoning population of 665 million in Africa now, but our listeners will get a real feel for the exponential nature of population growth if they follow with me that by the year 2000, Africa will have 884 million people. And by the year 2020, before the rest of the world has doubled, they'll be at 1.5 billion.
All by themselves.
And all by themselves. And that's just one continent. And we haven't even touched on the continents that have the largest human numbers and the largest massive population, and that's Asia, where between India and China alone, we're looking at close to 40% of the world's population.
Once again, we're talking to Werner Fornos from the Population Institute. You have said that population growth, especially as it impacts Asia and Africa, creates what you call man-made, unnatural disasters. Instead of natural disasters, these are unnatural disasters. Why is that so? What happens?
Because you cannot possibly accommodate. An example is that the Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome has now notified the Secretary General of the United Nations that some 65 nations may not be able to feed their populations by the year 2000. They have gone beyond what they can produce. And we've talked about local welfare cases and state welfare problems, but I don't think anybody ever imagined that we were going to have 65 nations put themselves at the feet of the rest of the world and said, take care of us. And when I talk about unnatural disasters, the deforestation we spoke of is a best example of marginal farming. In the Royal Kingdom of Nepal, people pressed for fuel have cut down the Himalayan foothills trees from India all the way to China over the last 10 years. enormous deforestation. Hard-pressed farmers trying to increase food production in order to feed the burgeoning population have gone into these marginal areas, the foothills of the Himalayas, and with terrace farming have gone higher and higher and higher, not realizing that they were destroying nature's buffer zone. Because that buffer zone of vegetation and trees was there to gently distribute the great monsoon rains through the subcontinent, at first through the four major rivers that have their origin in Nepal, and then down through the Delta Plains into finally winding up in Bangladesh. Well, 4 years of massive loss of topsoil has now caused stark rock formations to be where once powerful trees were, trees that were almost like candles on the altar of God, majestic trees, excuse me. Now when the monsoons come, the force of the water comes cascading down from those hills, flooding many regions in its wake, spilling over the river banks, and eventually all that water winds up in Bangladesh, a delta nation. And so you see most of the country flooded, causing great loss of life, causing tremendous misery, and at a price to the international relief community that far eclipses anything that population efforts would have needed in resources in 3 years. So with one man-made flood, you're looking at disaster relief needed to solve that problem. We haven't solved it because the only way you're going to solve it is to take that topsoil back up onto the Himalayan foothills and then anchor it with vegetation and reforest the foothills so that we turn it to its natural state. Many of us much more recently followed the devastating flooding that occurred in the Philippines, claiming over 10,000 lives. That flooding came, again, as a result of anxious people to make money, ignoring natural plains that should be preserved and not disturbed. They went in and they clear-cut whole regions outside a major city. And then when the rains came and there were no longer any trees, mudslides occurred on the hillside, and all of that mud wound up in the city and had this tremendous loss of life.
I have to ask you, is it even conceivable that human beings could organize to return topsoil and plant on those mountaintops?
It depends on how badly off you are and how much you've been brought down to your knees. We human beings have a tendency, though we are the species given the brains to see danger on the horizon and are equipped to make necessary course corrections, we don't make those necessary course corrections until it's almost too late. In China, they are now using huge brigades of workers, men and women, to dredge the bottom of the Yangtze River, where all of the topsoil has gone from provinces like Sichuan, loading it back onto the barge, pulling it back upstream 1,000 miles, and putting it back on the fields because they need to keep the field productivity in order to be able to feed the 175 million. These numbers get a little bit staggering, so forgive me, but 1,175,000,000. And China, even with as much spoken about population policy, is now growing at a rate where they're going to add 16 million people this year. And by the year 2000, which is only 3,000 days away from now, they're going to have a population added to the population of China equal to that of Great Britain, France, and Italy. And we may very well, if things don't go right, see starvation and the outbreak of starvation in biblical terms.
This is Conversations. We're talking with Werner Fornos. I'm Susan McGinnis. I'm your host. My guest today, before he joined the Population Institute, served as assistant professor at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. There he headed the university's Population Information Program. He also has served as a management consultant on family planning programs with the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID. We'll talk more about that organization in a while. The American Public Health Association, Westinghouse Health Systems, and others, and has worked on family planning projects for as many countries as Tunisia, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Turkey, Mexico, the Philippines, Indonesia, China, Sri Lanka, and Kenya. Conversations. You know, you were saying that international relief organizations simply cannot keep up. We think of the United Nations, we think of USAID, and a few others when we think of organizations which are trying to deal with the problems of the globe as a collective purpose. Absent disasters, are these organizations able to cope with anywhere near with the problem that faces them?
Not given the current resource availability. You know, you could have added UNICEF to that, the United Nations Development Program, the United Nations Environment Program, the International High Commissioner for Refugees, now taking care of 15 million refugees in refugee camps around the world. And a new category of refugees is emerging, environmental refugees. And there could be as many as 500 million environmental refugees by the year 2030, by the time the world's population doubles now to 10 billion people. We have to find a commitment from this wonderful breakthrough that the Cold War is now behind us, and we have to find some way to energize resources that will make sure that we see a world that is in balance and that will use sustainable development. My students ask me always, sustainable development, it's such a, I bet there's a long textbook about that. Sustainable development is quite simply that the current generation enriches itself not at the expense of the next generation. And I'm afraid that we're dangerously narrowing the options because of our callous behavior for future generations. I mean, every generation has had awesome challenges to face and have in most cases faced them. But I dare say no generation has ever faced the awesome test of whether it is going to leave a habitable planet for our children and our grandchildren. So let's talk about just the population thing, which I'm most familiar with, though I know that the needs and the demands are in other areas. The United Nations Population Fund is the largest provider of family planning assistance in the world. Its current allocation, not its budget, because it needs far more money than it has available, but it this year will have received from donor nations, voluntary donations from countries, $220 million. It needs about $1 billion to carry out just the demands that have been placed upon it by the 140-some nations who want to limit their family size and their demographic explosion. It's incapable of meeting that mandate. On the one hand, it has a mandate to respond to those requests, yet it doesn't get the money. You know, and it isn't going to get the job done unless the largest donor nation in the world, the United States, is back as a participant. At the moment, every industrialized nation is donating to the UN Population Fund. Most of them have doubled their contributions in the last 10 years. And we have gone through now 7 years where the Reagan and Bush administration have blocked funding that has been mandated by the Congress for the United Nations Population Fund over that very divisive debate in our country, in our society, over abortion.
The last time we talked, George Bush was running for office, and you said you had some hope that given his past track record, he would turn that around. Never happened.
Yeah, I don't understand his fealty to the extremists in our society. He certainly doesn't need them to win elections, yet he has become even more intractable on this issue than Ronald Reagan was. And it's an indefensible position that defies understanding. It's morally and ethically indefensible to cut off aid to 140 nations through the United Nations over supposedly what's going on in China. See, the whole premise of this cutoff was that the UN was giving $10 million in contraceptives aid to China, and that therefore, even though the Chinese program is a $1 billion program, their own family planning program amounts to $1 billion from their own resources, and the UN was providing things that they did not have available to them within their own borders. For instance, the United Nations built two IUD, intrauterine device manufacturing plants, because the IUD that the Chinese women were using, which was a steel ring, had a 40% failure rate. And so I don't understand how people who supposedly are opposed to abortion would deny assistance to provide a more effective contraceptive which would prevent these positively hideous failure rates, and therefore most failure rates result in abortion.
To put it baldly, was this in your mind a red herring created purposefully to make a political statement?
I think this particular policy has its origins in the Vatican, and that there has been a deal made between President Reagan and President Bush to show greater concern for Catholic doctrine out of the Vatican and thereby try to win many Catholic votes and support from the Vatican for their position in many other arenas. And therefore, they have cut off assistance to the most powerful population organizations. And their stridency on this issue, which is increasing on a daily basis, was never more evident than it was at the recent preparatory committee meeting, preparatory committee number 4, for the upcoming United Nations Conference on the Environment and Development, the what we now call the Earth Summit. The Vatican's representatives lobbied in every single committee for the removal of the word population or family planning that had survived 3 preparatory committees with all the nations of the world participating. And in Agenda 21, they have even succeeded in erasing population from that and saying that besides consumption rates, besides technological changes, we should also be mindful of appropriate demographic interventions. Appropriate demographic interventions.
Translate.
Well, that means that might be natural family planning instead of modern medically approved methods of family planning. 3 sections of Agenda 21 have still some population in it, but they're so cleverly disguised that you have to be a population expert to understand that we're talking about a world growing too rapidly and having to come to grips with excessive fertility.
Both religious and political winds impact how able we are to cope with growing population in this earth. Do they both sometimes work strongly against our ability to control our population internationally?
Well, I think both the Vatican and the administration are powerful obstacles to solving the population problem. However, wherever human beings have the knowledge and the means to control their fertility, they are doing so despite these obstacles. The largest Catholic country in our hemisphere, Brazil, now has a contraceptive prevalency rate of 60%. The danger is that 50% of Brazil is under 15 years of age, and therefore they're just about to end their reproductive years, part of this $3 billion that we talked about at the top of the hour. And it's an enormous challenge to empower people. And I think what bothers me about it most of all is that the people who are being punished by these arrogant religious policies or political policies are the women of the world. There is, to me, a deep-seated suspicion of women involved in here that works to keep them enslaved in a cycle of unnecessary pregnancies, keeps them enslaved in dogma that gives very little credence to the value of womanhood. And it deeply bothers me. I mean, women do 2/3 of the world's work today. They only earn 1/10 of the income. They own only 1% of the property. And there's some sort of a conspiracy against women. Now, hopefully that will end this year. I'm optimistic in the biggest turnover in Congress since 1948 coming about. 1948, we had 118 new members. I'm hoping that this time we're going to see somewhere around 150 new members, and I'd like to see 75 of those 150 be women. I think we'll see a tremendous change in the House of Representatives if that happens, and the very great likelihood exists that we're going to see at least a baker's dozen of United States women in the Senate. Never before have we had more than 2, and that's the record we have now. When women come onto the scene and participate in the policymaking of a nation, they have a powerful influence in the decency and the direction of humanity through humanitarian means that the government all of a sudden assumes.
Do you think worldwide it will make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're seeing, you know, you have to realize 98% of all lawmakers in the world are men, yet half of the world's population is women. And so if we invest in women during this decade, as we have never before done, then I'd have lots of hope for the 21st century. But it's going to require eradicating illiteracy, attacking the illiteracy of the 600 million women who are illiterate in the world today. And I'm not singling out women for getting smart. Men have always had access to education. But there's an old Muslim saying, if you educate a man, you educate one person. If you educate a woman, you educate a whole nation. And I don't know why these male obstacles have to continue to be there. I mean, it's just beyond me. I'm sorry.
You have looked at gender, briefly at religious obstacles to change, and we've mentioned political obstacles to change that are some global, some regional. Does this argue that an international commitment to population control or reversing the terrible impact on the environment or even economic stability, does it argue that there has to be an international commitment guided and coordinated by an international body? I'm wondering, will the UN have to take over here?
Well, we have become a world without borders. Air pollution or water pollution respects no boundaries. The damage caused by one nation to its own environment seriously affects a neighboring nation. An example, because of terribly bad coal being burned in England, we are destroying the spruce forests of Sweden. We are seeing the salmon hatching industry of Norway affected by acid rain. Both are sovereign nations. There is no mechanism today for them to cope with this. It may very well be that as the European economic market expands, that they will set up common pollution control devices and common enforcement mechanisms. But I submit to you that we will see during our lifetime a drastic change. And maybe we will already see the beginning at UNCTAD, the Earth Summit. See, I don't see the Earth Summit as an end. I see it as a beginning, a process that hopefully will lead to the establishment of a new environmental sanity agenda and then a program to implement that agenda. And one of the major things that I believe will have to happen, and this involves sacrificing some sovereignty. And I can already hear the Rush Limbaughs and the Pat Buchanan saying, shame, 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 giving up American sovereignty. It isn't what we want to do. It's what we're going to have to do if we want to see this planet preserved for our children. The planet will always be here. But it's the human species we're talking about preserving, and it cannot preserve itself when it's being choked to death and drowned in its own success, in its own garbage. So I see a movement. No one may believe today that this movement will come, but and they may say, well, Werner Fornos is just pipe dreaming. But I think that you'll see that the Security Council of the United Nations is going to have broadened powers, including the protection of life across borders that is affected by environmental destruction. If you have a Volkswagen plant that cannot live up to the clean air standards in Pennsylvania, and it then picks up all of its machinery and moves to Tijuana, Mexico, and sets up there, it is still polluting at a dangerous level and causes effect to the citizens of the United States. At the moment, the only recourse we have is to go to war with Mexico and shut down this plant. That's not the way to peacefully resolve great issues. So I think that as the environmental issues intensify, bringing us to our knees. In desperation, we will turn to the United Nations, as we have done in so many arenas recently, and look for a new mechanism to be able to have an environmental police force that has sanctions and ability to say, you have no right to interfere with the health of neighbors, even though you're so mighty and so powerful that you can overwhelm them overnight. I also believe that the president is acting foolishly when he's asking for an expedited protocol on the trade agreement with Mexico. That means that he will submit the protocol and it's not open to amendment by the Congress. You can either vote yes or no. And tell you why I'm worried about it, not from a trade standpoint, but Mexico has almost no environmental protection laws. And so corporations, hard-pressed to implement stringent environmental protection laws in the United States, say, hey, it's not worth the money to adopt these, and they will move out to the neighboring country where they have no environmental protection laws and where it's cheaper to produce their products, even though they will foul their nest.
This is Werner Fornos. We're talking today about population and the growth of a population worldwide that impacts on several different levels. Werner Fornos graduated from the University of Maryland, taking degrees in government and in politics. He has served the Maryland State Legislature, did so from 1966 to 1970. Among his honors, he has been selected as a Rotary International Paul Harris Fellow and is also recipient of the 1991 Humanist of the Year Award. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. I want to turn to health issues. We have talked around them in the course of this portion of the hour, but not directly to them. Two issues intrigue me particularly. Some 30 years ago, we were well on the way in this United States to resolving the problem of tuberculosis. Somewhere along the line, we forgot to follow through. Tuberculosis is back in new and virulent forms, impacting mostly poor people in the United States, migrant workers, people in jails, people in ghettos. It's also impacting another population, which raises the second health question. It's impacting people with HIV. When they get AIDS, they are particularly vulnerable to tuberculosis. One problem, we haven't dealt with AIDS at its onset. The other, we let go as a nation before it was resolved. What do problems like these predict for us in terms of the health of this world?
Well, you see that the latest report from Health and Human Services is that we're experiencing some small progress in infant mortality being lowered, even though very few of us realize that the population at risk that is experiencing high infant mortality, which keeps us from achieving a lower level, are those who smoke and who drink and during pregnancy, et cetera. But in the cases of TB, it's not just in the United States that we're seeing this reoccurrence of what we thought was a conquered disease. We're seeing it especially through huge movements of migration. And so if you have a million new people coming to the country and moving into most of the ghettos of the country, many of them never health tested even in their native country, they can bring a whole slew of diseases with them, and certainly TB, but also most recently cholera. In Lima, Peru, because the water system and the sewage system have become so deteriorated by the demand of 9 million people in a system that was built for 1 million people, you saw the outbreak of cholera in that whole Andes region. And we see it also in Egypt, where the city of Cairo is now so overburdened and so overpopulated that the cemeteries have been ripped open, the vaults are being occupied by families because they have no other place to live. And so in underdeveloped countries, disease is again a major factor to be worried about. And I think it's the onset of nature stepping in and taking care of the population problem for us. Certainly, I do not accept the argument that HIV and AIDS is going to be a new form of population control, even though there will be tremendous suffering. I mean, the World Health Organization now tells us that by the year 1995, we will have between 15 and 30 million people dead or dying from AIDS. Large populations in Africa are having serious problems. My recent visit to Tanzania, the health minister told me that one out of every three children born last year had the HIV virus. We're seeing no one immune to the problem of AIDS. I mean, everybody says, I can't get it. It's someone else's problem. The president of Zambia, President Kaunda, himself a medical physician, has lost his son to AIDS. And so the stories, once they touch us and once we find a friend affected, and it doesn't have to be a friend that that is your intimate partner. It can be a friend who you're very fond of. On my international the Population Institute's International Advisory Committee is Arthur Ashe. And Arthur is now going through this terrible agony. And when I heard the announcement, I'm not usually given the tears, but I could feel my eyes well up because he's been struggling with heart problems for several years. And it just it will strike everybody. The most recent statistic out of the Center for Disease Control is that one in 250 Americans now has HIV. And if we continue as we are going by the year 2000, that'll be down to one in 100. And that's probably the worst health epidemic that we've ever experienced. And so we have to really redouble our efforts in trying to find a vaccine that can stop the spread of this terrible disease. But while we're waiting for that, it means us practicing responsible sexual behavior and thinking also about making sure that we respect our partners and that we try to become as monogamous as possible so that this terrible disease is, through improvement in sexual responsibility, arrested.
We have, I think, 10 minutes left. I want you to, if you will, look to the solutions for... Solutions is such an odd word, but if we are to address the problems of exploding world population, what are the best ways to do it that will have the most long-reaching impact, far-reaching impact?
Well, the one that will buy us time is to make sure that that basic human right of couples having the right to determine the number and the spacing of their children is indeed available to every couple in the world. Today, the World Fertility Survey tells us that, and this is not an American creation, this is a product of the International Statistical Institute in The Hague, tells us that there are some 500 million women in the world today who want no more children. Most of them didn't want their last child, but they lack the education and the means to do anything about it. Empowering them with the knowledge and the means of fertility regulation, from natural family planning, for those that it works, to modern medically approved methods of family planning. And when we're talking about family planning, we're not talking about abortion. Abortion is not a method of family planning. Abortion is really, in a much more deep-rooted sense, involved with the failure of society to prevent unwanted pregnancies. During this terribly divisive debate now, which has gone on ever since 1972 when Roe versus Wade was passed, has seen no decline in abortions. No decline in abortions. On the contrary, in 1980, when the first president committed himself to removing Roe versus Wade and overturning it, at that time there were 30 million abortions estimated worldwide. Today, for 1991, the estimate is up to 70 million abortions. That's a potent symbol for the demand of family planning, because I've never met anyone who wanted an abortion. What we need to do now is to mobilize the resources, moving rather quickly to $2.5 billion being spent on population programs in 1993, not just by the United States. We would be a very small part of it. We would be a fifth of it, maybe $500 million in American contributions, which is a small, small drop in the bucket. It's a cup of coffee and a donut once every 6 months from an American. You can understand. It's a half a six-pack. For those who, whether it's a half a six-pack of Cokes or whether it's a half a six-pack of your other favorite beverage, or even a half of a four-pack of Bartles and James with a little personality thrown in. So we have the technology. We have the resources if we're willing to commit them, if we care. And that's really what the big question is, do we care? I mean, last year we spent $2.5 billion, American tobacco companies did, on cigarette advertising. Last month, the former Soviet Union, going through a tremendous headache, for all of us feel sorry for them, but trying to subdue that headache, they spent $2.5 billion in buying vodka in just 1 month. $2.5 billion is what we spend daily, according to Jane's of London, on military expenditures. Why are we afraid to declare that we've won the war and that we no longer need to be engaged in the arms race? Let me just, in making a plea for this arms this transfer from arms budgets to humanitarian budgets, let me read you a most unlikely statement from a most unlikely source that has been very, very hesitant to make the kind of statement that I'm about to read from it, because they try to find answers through scientific means. And this statement, which was issued recently, says, if current predictions of population growth prove accurate and patterns of human activity on the planet remain unchanged, science and technology may not be able to prevent either irreversible degradation of the environment or continued poverty for much of the world. And this is the first joint statement by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and the Royal Society of London. The best scientific brains in the Western world now saying, four square, this is it, enough is enough. If you don't get your house in order, the house may very well crumble.
Okay. For the last 50-plus minutes, people have been listening to you, and I know there are people at the other end of their radios who, acting alone or as part of a service group or as part of their workforce or part of their university or school, elementary or high school, would like to do something in response to what they've heard over the last hour. What can you do? What can I do?
Well, we can do many things. First of all, I think all of us have to become better citizens. All of us have to become better citizens. That means we have to communicate to the Congress our concerns about not just the next election, but about the next generation and what the quality of life will be for our children and our grandchildren. People who are as bald as I am are not going to see the fallout of this creeping destruction of the planet. It's almost like putting a frog in a pot and turning on the heat underneath it on low and then slowly, slowly turning up that heat. At first, the frog won't feel it. He gets to be a little more uncomfortable, and eventually he'll expire. And I'm afraid that's what's happening to the human race if we do not make the necessary course corrections in the remaining days of the 21st century. Because of this 3 billion body of young people out there that are about to become sexually or parentally active, we've got to really make those changes. You can write to the Institute to be part of our priority declaration campaign, which seeks 1 million signatures to be presented to President Bush by June 10th, which says that there is a non-separable component between the environment and population, and we want you to address these issues again in unison and simultaneously. We're over 250,000 signatures in that. Anyone that fills out one of the recycled priority declarations in their neighborhood or community with 130 signatures gets a little gift out of it, a population environment T-shirt. We can also become very conservation conscious in our communities. Large buildings burn lights all night long with not a human soul in the building. We can get away from this commitment to a fossil fuel and fuelish appetite-conscious society by practicing conservation. We can walk, we can carpool, we can bicycle. We can prevent waste. Many people are now into recycling. We need to do much more, but we can prevent waste. One of the best ways, I guess, that we can do things about what's happening is we can pass legislation to prohibit newspapers, let's start with the Sunday paper first, from using anything but recycled paper in the printing of these giant 220-page Los Angeles Times, New York Times, Washington Post. We all get a Sunday paper that winds in the trash can, and then we're exhorted to recycle it. Why don't we ask them to use recycled paper in the first place? Yes, someone will say that'll cost a little bit more money, but they're today producing recycled paper in Georgia. I can give any newspaper the address cheaper than what we're buying newsprint for on the open market and what we're killing trees for in order to produce these newsprints rolls, that huge rolls that go into our daily newspapers. There are a lot of other things. You can write to the Population Institute at 107 2nd Street Northeast in Washington, D.C., and say, I want to help. I want to make a commitment to be a grassroots volunteer for solving the issue, and I want to donate 10 hours in this coming year to do anything that needs to be done to raise the consciousness of the American people to this very, very grave situation.
There are also service organizations in most towns that have done made fairly tremendous contributions globally, it seems to me.
Yes.
Rotary is one, is it not?
Rotary has done Polio Plus campaign, and after that successful camp, Polio Plus was to raise sufficient funds through Rotary clubs around the world to buy enough vaccine to vaccinate each child in the world against polio. And here's an example of a service club that put service to community above yourself, and they've done it. Other service clubs can also get involved. I'd like to see Kiwanis get in a campaign to raising enough money to buy 5 million packages of oral rehydration powder, which costs 10 cents a package. One package can save the life of a child dying from extreme or acute diarrhea. There are so many things that all of us can do. This is not a hopeless situation. I'm involved in trying to bring about the balance between population and the environment and resources of this planet, because I think future generations deserve it, and because I love children myself. I'm totally puzzled by this compassion for life in uterus and then abandoning children across the world.
Werner Fornos, an admirer, said of you at one point that it sometimes looks like Werner Fornos is alone fighting the battle of population control. Do you sometimes feel that's true? Is that changing?
No, I don't. The Institute has 80,000 members at this point. We're supported by 30,000 individual contributors and about 49 foundations. And though I have calluses on my knees from looking for the resources to keep the Institute going and doing the many things it needs to do to make this an international priority, I see a greater consciousness now than ever before. And I think that we are at a point in history where this will be the issue that is going to get the attention of our lawmakers, and we're going to solve the population problem before the 21st century comes around.
Werner Fornos, I want to thank you, and
thank you, Susan.
Some hope that you're accurate. Can you give the address to the Population Institute one more time for people who scrambled for their pencils?
Yes, it's at the Population Institute at 107 2nd Street Northeast, Washington, D.C., 2002. And if you come to Washington, come visit us, and we'll arrange for briefings on population issues and how you can help.
If you're interested in reading more, Werner Fornos' book, Gaining People, Losing Ground, was published in 1990 by Science Press. I'm Susan McGinnis. You've been listening to Conversations, and I hope you'll join me again next week. Thank you, Werner Fornos.
Thank you, Susan.